Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a real honor to be here, a real privilege to be here among distinguished guests. In my talk today, I'm going to sort of outline a conceptual framework for understanding psychological well-being in adulthood and old age in light of the evolved human life history. So human life history, as we know, consists of lots of investment, grand parental investment, but also parental investment. Truly requires a level of cooperation that is unparalleled, both within sexual relationships, but also among kin, and broader social networks among non-kin. And so much of what we know about psychological well-being comes from large-scale modern societies, where well-being is often associated with greater income, at least to a certain point, social status, social support. In contrast, very little is known about psychological well-being in small-scale societies. Do we observe similar patterns, for example, with respect to the importance of economic production, social networks on psychological well-being? And so you might ask, well, why focus on small-scale societies to study something like this? Well, socioecology has a sort of unique mixture of features, both common risk factors for things like depression, reduced psychological well-being in modern societies, things like food scarcity, poverty, no access to healthcare, but also common buffers, kin support, relative egalitarianism, minimal social isolation, etc. So we can really examine the relative importance of each one of these factors and how they determine well-being. So basically today I'm going to review what we know about psychological well-being in small-scale societies, mostly using Chimane data. I'll compare these patterns with some of the broader patterns that we see in large-scale societies, try to make sense of it all, and maybe pose some new research questions. Okay, and so we start by defining psychological well-being. It can be very, very complicated, as Dr. Sumi and Nowak, they've confronted some of these similar issues in their work on captive primates. I'm generally thinking about psychological well-being as a continuum from happiness to sadness. These are cross-culturally recognized emotions. So the figure on the left here shows various core affective emotional states varying on two dimensions. You see valence going from negative to positive, arousal going from high to low, and the words here show some of these core affective states in a trait space within a quadrant. And so, of course, there are four quadrants. You can see something like depression, negative valence, relatively low arousal, contrasted with something like fear, negative valence, high arousal. And so the figure on the right shows an example of how an organism's affective state can change over time. And so good states, or the good times, you can think about as this loop here, moving from quadrant one to quadrant two, and you can see that it can be cyclical, but there are times when it can also veer off into the bad times, quote unquote, where you're moving in between quadrants three and four. So today I'm going to focus mostly on depression. You can think about psychological well-being across this continuum. I'm going to focus mainly on depression, given its overrepresentation in psychological well-being research in humans and its increasing contribution to the global burden of disease. When I talk about depression, I'm defining it here rather broadly but non-clinically. So I'm not using the DSM criteria to define depression, but the general framework that I'm going to introduce today not only attempts to explain things like depression, but emotions within the entire continuum, so negative to positive affect as well. So the talk is divided into three parts. First, I'm going to present this conceptual model of psychological well-being in adulthood and old age. And basically, the model specifies a direct effect of functional status, functional ability, and economic productivity on psychological well-being, on mood. And so this is part 1A. And then an indirect effect, where greater productivity can facilitate greater bidirectional transfers, but also mainly downward transfers is how I'm thinking about this. And so I'm going to evaluate this conceptual model using ongoing data that we're collecting among a large representative sample of Chimane adults. And so I'm gonna incorporate data from other societies and perhaps other species in talking about both parts 1A and 1B. In the second part, I'm gonna slightly shift the emphasis to sexual relationships, things like marriage. We can think about marriage as really complex reciprocal relationships that may be really poised to influence human psychological well-being given the central role of resource production and distribution transfers within that unit. So I'm going to identify some common threats to household productivity, household transfers, by focusing on marital conflict, what we know about marital conflict in small-scale societies. This is some of my ongoing research with the Chimane. And I'm going to highlight the role of socioecology in affecting variability in responses, psychological responses to some of these adversities when we see, for example, social conflict or sexual conflict occurring. And then lastly, I'll compare the life history approach we're trying to develop with some of the other approaches. So the general hypothesis that we're testing is that psychological well-being is going to be determined by the ability to produce and transfer resources that have fitness value, what we call the productive value model. Here I'm going to examine four individual level determinants of functional ability, economic productivity, age, energetic status, infectious status, functional disability. You can think about these as the independent variables. And I'm going to consider a few indicators of psychological well-being. First, food anxiety, or essentially psychological distress over lack of nutritious, stable food supplies. This is something that's a major life stressor cross-culturally, often associated with indicators of reduced psychological well-being. I'm also going to talk about our ongoing work with depression, and also introduce some measures of subjective well-being using the Cantrell ladder, for example. So note that there are two y-axes. We'll start with this first indicator of psychological well-being, food anxiety. And you can see two y-axes. On the left is a predicted probability of reporting food anxiety. On the right, you can see net daily productivity. And so this dotted line here represents the age profile of net productivity in small-scale societies. So we're starting at the age of 20. After that long period of net dependence on parents, and you can see really steep increases in food in production with age, plateauing in the mid-40s and then slowly declining. But you can notice that even into the late 60s, early 70s, adults are continuing to be net producers. And so because the ability to produce food in small-scale societies is strongly age-dependent, age is a core determinant of strength and skill, we hypothesize that the likelihood of experiencing something like food anxiety should vary by age, but also by energetic status, as energetic status might influence the ability to produce and transfer. And so here you can see two lines. One, the top one refers to the Chimane with low BMI, two standard deviations below the mean, and here's Chimane with high BMI, as you might expect. Chimane with high BMI report a lower likelihood of experiencing food anxiety. But you notice, if you look at the age profile, likelihood of reporting anxiety stays high in the early 20s, despite low dependency ratios, despite few deleterious effects of senescence on the ability to produce food. This is a time when young parents are heavily dependent on younger grandparents. So you can see food anxiety stays very high in the 20s when productivity is still low. Parents are still relatively unproductive. And then you see sharp declines as net productivity is increasing. And interestingly, you actually see the nadir of reporting food anxiety at peak productivity. We didn't expect that the results would come out this way. They just happened to do so. So you can also see these main effects of BMI that I referenced earlier. So some indication that, yes, the ability to produce and transfer food is affecting psychological well-being, as indicated by food anxiety. So we're collecting data on depression using a ecologically valid, reliable instrument. And if you look at the age profile of Chimane depression scores, here it's expressed as a percentile, you can see that depression is increasing with age in older adulthood. It's not a linear effect. But basically, as functional ability is declining, the ability to produce is slowly declining with age, you see these increases in depression. You also see some interaction effects between age and BMI, such that age-related increase in depression is particularly strong for those individuals with poor energetic status. In other analyses not shown here, We also found that energetic status is a pretty good predictor at older ages of the ability to work, chop trees, lift heavy loads, etc. So in addition to age-related physical decline, in addition to poor energetic status, acute or chronic morbidity, this is another really important impediment to producing and transferring resources. So during routine medical exams, we asked Chimani to compare their current health status to last year, and that's what the x-axis is showing. You can see the distribution of responses compared to last year. My health is 20% of individuals reported slightly better. Most people are reporting either the same or slightly worse. Much better was an option, but not one individual actually chose that option in a sample of over 500 people. So this gives you some insight into how prevalent morbidity is and its potential for really affecting psychological well-being. And so you'll notice that the converse can also apply, namely that good health can actually induce positive affect. It's not just the case that disability may induce negative affect. Good health may actually induce positive affect if it's associated with higher productivity, greater transfers, and so this might actually suggest that part of the motivation behind work, not just the ability to work, but actually the motivation can derive from good health. And indeed, if you look across diverse societies, good health appears to be associated with greater subjective well-being. So here's some data from the multi-site Project Age. I think this was NIA funded, so it's nice to see the data come full circle. Showing the mean well-being scores as a function of self-reported health. So self-reported health here is crudely divided. You have poor, fair, average, good, all the way to excellent. And these mean scores are standardized out of 100, so 50 means that an individual is reporting that they fall somewhere in the middle on this ladder, this Cantrell ladder. Okay, and so I want to emphasize two results in this table. Number one, if you look within all of these different, really disparate societies, subjective well-being is increasing with self-reported health. In some cases, you might see threshold effects across, obviously, only three data points. Others, perhaps, you might see some fairly linear increase. But across societies, you can see that the percentage increase, so if you compare this value with this value, the percentage increase in subjective well-being based on health is particularly strong in subsistence economies, not so much for market economies. And so in subsistence economies, the relationship between your health and your ability to work, to produce food, is particularly strong relative to sedentary modern societies. And of course, in subsistence societies, you can't really manage production shortfalls related to disability with technology, hearing aids, or glasses, or things like this. Or of course, you can't liquidate a savings account. And so we might expect particularly strong effects or implications for psychological well-being. And so as part of our monitoring of functional ability among older Chimani, so Chimani over the age of 50, we have adults perform a variety of exercises that have been used previously in the MacArthur studies. And so the x-axis here represents this composite score of an individual's ability to carry out some of these exercises, where higher scores indicate greater disability of those that are able to participate, that is. And so this score likely captures both acute and chronic disability. But you can generally see that disability score is strongly associated with depression, even after controlling for some of these other factors. Age is also controlled. I left that out here. I'm sorry about that. But this disability score alone, this is the strongest predictor of depression among Chimane. When you control for these other factors, disability score alone explains about 25% of the variance in depression score. And this might actually be a conservative estimate because I'm also controlling for acute morbidity. So the other noteworthy thing about this result is that once you include this variable in the model, the effect of age on depression drops out. Okay, so it's really the case that functional status, functional ability, is a mediator. It's mediating the effect of aging on psychological well-being, which is a finding I think that's consistent with other studies in modern societies. And so here on top, you can see the conceptual model that I've been referencing throughout, where the dotted lines are hypothesized negative effects, solid lines are positive effects. Part 1A, I really focused on this relationship here, effects of disability on productivity, effects of disability on psychological well-being. Now I'm going to briefly discuss some factors that might mediate this relationship, particularly here. supports given and received. And so by social support, I'm really referring to both material forms of support, calories, but also non-material forms of support, advice, knowledge, childcare, et cetera, something that's not easily measurable. And so in this conceptual model, higher productivity facilitates greater transfers, and giving and receiving of support are linked. And so this, I think, is very consistent with what we see in small-scale societies where preferential sharing partnerships are formed, people share less with those who give less, and high producers are really valuable social partners, as are generous individuals. And so what do I mean by that? Here you can see some data collected among the Aceh. And so if you look at the quantity of food received and the quantity of meat received during really needy periods, during disability, during illness, you can see that philanthropic individuals, so these are people that produce a lot, and of what they're producing, they're sharing a very high percentage. Philanthropic individuals receive lots of assistance, but also the people who mean well, so these are individuals that don't necessarily produce a lot, but of what they produce, a high percentage is shared. These are also people that receive lots of assistance, whereas in contrast, greedy individuals and never do well, so these are people that don't produce much, don't share much. Greedy people produce a lot, but they don't share much. These people don't necessarily receive as much assistance. So again, productivity, generosity, highly valued, and likely important in affecting resilience to certain unpredictable events and adversity. In modern societies, providing support may increase well-being, even if the aid isn't reciprocated. And so most studies actually lump the giving and the receiving of support into one composite score, something like social contact, which you see here. And when you lump the giving and the receiving of support, it really limits your ability to determine which is more important in affecting the outcome. And so here you can see data from a prospective study of mortality that actually disaggregates the giving of support and the receiving of support. And as you might expect, you can replicate the effect of just social contact. This is the aggregate measure. But as soon as you start adding these other variables, you can easily see that it's the giving of support that has a much higher, a stronger effect on reducing mortality than it is the receiving. In fact, you actually see some evidence that receiving support and net dependence increases risk. And so this idea that feeling burdensome is associated with suicidal tendencies, feelings of hopelessness, depression in both the younger and older adults, you can see that to an extent is reflected in this data. The relationship between giving support and psychological well-being may actually be conserved in some species. If you see, look at the figure on the left, so this is among Barbary macaque females, more grooming of other females. So this is referring to the number of females that are groomed, the amount of time spent grooming per female is associated with reduced cortisol metabolites from fecal samples, perhaps suggesting lower levels of psychological psychosocial stress among people, macaques that give lots of support. In contrast, you look at the figure on the right, the amount of grooming that's received isn't necessarily correlated with HPA axis activation. And I just want to note that I drew these lines, I superimposed these, this is not real. National Academy of Sciences, it's a great place to make up data. So my understanding of Barbary macaque social structure, we actually see some biparental care within these matriarchies. And so there may speculatively be some conserved links between life histories, in particular the extent to which resources are pooled, the pooled energy budgets, and physiological responses to resource transfers or failed transfers in some cases. And so there are well-documented associations between social isolation, reduced psychological well-being in modern societies, other well-being proxies like mortality risk, as shown here. So for example, some meta-analyses report the effect of having a high-quality social relationship on reducing mortality rivals well-established risk factors like quitting smoking. A common interpretation of these findings is that isolation entails less support that's received. But isolation, of course, also entails less ability to give to others. And we know that the net downward transfers, as I think Paul will talk about tomorrow, net downward transfers are really a robust feature of human life histories. And so we should expect maybe a tight linkage between psychological well-being and actually giving support. And of course, a modal age of adult death of about 70 in foragers, forager horticulturalists, means really that adults are net producing their whole lives, their whole adult lives. And so this does is it might minimize the risk of intergenerational conflicts over how resources are used and allocated, and actually minimizes the risk of social isolation, because even some of the oldest adults are still highly productive. So to quickly summarize part one, oh my gosh, 5 minutes. Okay, so let's move on to part two quickly. In part two, I'm going to use the logic that I'm developing in part one and apply it specifically to sexual relationships. So marriage is ubiquitous, necessary to obtain high quality nutrients upon which humans rely. Of all relationships, marriage probably involves the most cooperation, also the most conflict. And so common causes of divorce, you can see common causes of divorce worldwide reflect inefficiencies regarding production and transfers within these relationships. In modern societies, we know there's some evidence that relative to remaining single, those that enter into marriage actually has a positive effect on psychological well-being, and of course the opposite. Marital problems predict depression for both sexes. So life history models of marriage really do a pretty good job of incorporating both cooperative and conflictive aspects. And conflicts of interest are essentially resolved through negotiations. Partners can vary in their bargaining power. But the key point is that the outcome doesn't always have to be equitable, just better than the alternative, single parenthood, remarriage, et cetera. And so here is sort of a hypothetical framework of how bargaining may occur within marriage, where the X and Y axes represent men's inputs, contributions to household versus private goods. And point A here is the optimal for the male, subject to this budget constraint, but female, the wife, has some minimal acceptable level of household contribution that she tolerates, otherwise the relationship dissolves, and so the man then chooses the suboptimal point B to avoid being deserted. So this is just to highlight really that bargaining is a prevalent feature within marriage. Many determinants of bargaining power in societies lacking controllable wealth. Given men's greater size, given men's greater strength, we might expect something like intimate partner violence to be used as a bargaining chip. And in fact, we see pretty high rates of intimate partner violence within Shimani marriages. And so here you can see within the first year of marriage, about 50% of wives report experiencing violence. By year five, over 70% of wives report experiencing violence. And so IPV, intimate partner violence, is extremely prevalent despite the lack of patriarchal institutions in Shimani society. And if you actually look at what is driving some of these instances, it's really conflict, verbal disputes, over men's withdrawal of resources from the family. So this is, again, affecting the ability to produce, the ability to transfer within at the household level. So this is a construct that I call paternal disinvestment. You can see the vast majority of all instances of violence have to do with some complaint over the husband's behavior. And so the extent to which the husband's paternal disinvestment may affect psychological well-being should be largely mediated by the availability of kin, particularly from the wife's perspective. So relational wealth can be conceptualized as a bargaining chip. And here you can see a structural equation model of intimate partner violence among Shimani. I just want to direct your attention to this box here. This is the reflecting whether residence is matrilocal. And so these lines are dotted, they're negative. And so you can see clear negative effects of matrilocal residence on husband's infidelity, alcoholism, male village absenteeism. And you also see clear, strong negative effects of matrilocal residence on disputes in marriage and also on intimate partner violence. You can see that in this model, even when you control for matrilocal residence, the strongest direct effect on whether or not wives report experiencing any violence is a husband's infidelity. And so I'm going to skip this slide, I'm short on time. Skip this slide as well. 1 minute. All right. So to summarize briefly part two, we generally see sexual conflict among Chimane. It's driven largely by paternal disinvestment, but the extent to which this disinvestment affects maternal psychological well-being is highly variable, both within Chimane and also in other societies. And so you might ask, well, why do we see such high variability? I would suspect that part of this is the result of variability in the availability of alternative forms of investment. So if I can't rely on a husband for whatever reason, or kin around, or can I personally contribute to household economy? And so my general statement here is that psychological well-being is extremely sensitive to some of the core cooperative relationships that we see humans engage in. And so those factors that are affecting, those socio-ecological factors that are affecting the efficiency of production transfers within these core units, and here I highlight two examples, are likely to have profound implications for understanding variability in psychological well-being. Okay, I'll take one more minute, if that's okay.
I'm not in a position of authority to say that.
Okay, just to situate this model that I'm developing within some of the previous models. Darwin, this discussion goes back to Darwin about the extent to which emotion and mood is adaptive or non-adaptive, and a lot of adaptive hypotheses, a laundry list of adaptive hypotheses have tried to explain something like depression, is it functional? And so what I really just want to highlight in the chapter is that a lot of these approaches suffer from really severe limitations. There's either limited ecological variability. You can see I've included two examples of proposed benefits to depression. There may be limited ecological validity, limited empirical support, a whole series of limitations. And so I just want to emphasize the value added by a life history approach, and you can see some of the bullet points here, that we can sort of tackle variability and well-being over the life course, and how different life goals are changing, how psychological well-being might be responding to the importance and the changing nature of these goals, not only at different life stages, but also in different ecological contexts. And also I want to emphasize we're focusing on both cooperation and conflict, not just something like social competition, which is frequently emphasized in the literature. So I think I'm going to cut my presentation short in the interest of time. But thank you very much. Be happy to answer questions after.
Thank you.